Our reading today is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 7, commencing at verse 24. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice. But a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syro-Phoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child lying on the bed, and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went by way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. They brought to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. He took him aside in private, away from the crowd, and put his fingers into his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus ordered them to tell no one, but the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." Amen.
As you've been invited, you're allowed to leave questions that will be attended to, and unless otherwise directed, I'll probably answer some of those questions that you put in the question box that's just outside the chapel on the right-hand side. I'm going to answer this question today. Well, this is the first question I'm going to answer. When Jesus made a whip and drove the money changers from the temple, was he angry or was it some other emotion? This came from a conversation where I suspect I probably wasn't clear about the use of anger. And I think I may have indicated that to be angry was not a good Christian thing to do. Believe me, being angry is totally normal and it's okay. But let me just quickly run through this. And by the way, this is not you ask a question, I respond, and that's the end of it. If you've got a comeback or you want to check a piece of information, either now or later, feel free. So this is not, "I've answered that question, we move on," unless I say, "I've answered that question, we're moving on." I've got the right to veto. So there are each gospel records this event. Matthew, Mark and Luke do it very similarly. In this way, then Jesus entered the temple and drove out all who were selling and buying in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. He said to them, "It is written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer,' but you are making it a den of robbers." And there's a really good conversation about what is Jesus angry about, and that's an important thing to be aware of too. It's not just that they were selling things, but where was the praying? Where was this sense that this house was a house of prayer? So that's recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All who do it towards the end of their story, all who do it as Jesus is making his way towards crucifixion. John's Gospel offers it a little differently and does it at the beginning of his ministry. So it sets the tone very early. The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and the money changers seated at their tables, making a whip of cords, which is a pretty handy skill to have. I'm not quite sure how Jesus, maybe it's what they just learned. A whip of cords, he drove all of them out of the temple, both the sheep and the cattle. He also poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables, which is a pretty fair effort. I was talking with somebody just before worship, and if I was to flip this table, that that would be a monumental effort. It's a heavy table. It's, you know, to flip over tables and to keep doing that and to draw it, it's a lot of energy. It certainly says something, makes a big, bold statement. Take these things out of here. Stop making my Father's house a marketplace. His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me," and so on and so forth. Jesus quite clearly is expressing anger. What's commonly done with this is that we call this righteous anger, because we've had to justify, well, people, because good people don't get angry, do they? Well, obviously you're not the good ones then, are you? Because good Christians don't get angry. And if you know, I dare say that somewhere along the way, somebody may have suggested that to you. In fact, regardless of being Christian or not, even being angry is looked upon with a bit of disdain from some people. And to give permission for people to be angry, the term is given righteous anger. My response to that, that's a load of baloney. Quite frankly, there's no indication that there's righteous anger and unrighteous anger. And it's given as if to say this way of being and this reason for being angry is justified and appropriate. Jesus could be angry because that was righteous anger. You can't be angry about what you're angry about because you're being unrighteous. You're being silly. It's not big enough. It's not worth being angry about. Why? Get over it. Why are you being angry? Why don't you just move on? All those really helpful responses we get when people find themselves in the space of our emotions and they don't know what to do with them. We know what we would like to do with our anger. Anger is an emotion. It is neither right nor wrong. It simply is. Like grief, like happiness, like, I don't know, grumpiness, like any of those sorts of things that are emotions that just come to us, they're just emotions. They're neither right nor wrong. People are angry, we can be angry. It's okay. The presence of anger tells me I care about this. This is important. That's all it's doing. Anger is just a defense mechanism that tells me something has happened that has impinged upon something that I feel powerfully about, and now that has been impacted negatively in a way that I'm not happy about. When I get angry, it's me telling myself something's happened that has changed what I feel and has changed the scenario that I was in. And I want this to be cared about. I want to be able to care about this. Yeah? A better question, or another question might be, how do I give expression to this anger? So Jesus flips over tables and drives the money changers and animals out of the temple. My suggestion is don't go flipping over tables. It normally doesn't draw a great response from people, unless you feel particularly powerful about said table. But the real question is, okay, so you're angry, so now what do you do with it? How do you give expression to that anger? And that's where I'm going to finish now. But that's the question I'll leave you with. Nothing wrong with being angry, but how do you give expression to it? I think someone once said, and if you can tell me who it is, Anybody can be angry anywhere, anyhow, anytime. The real trick is to be angry for the right reason in the right place with the right people in the right way. And that just takes an enormous amount of effort. And it only begins because you ask yourself, why am I angry? And really, and then when you think you've got an answer, my suggestion would be, okay, so why is that the case? And then go another level, why is that the case? I say this from personal experience. The first level is probably not even really worth paying attention to. It's simply a little gateway that you have to go through to get to the next level. So I'm angry because, I don't know, what could I be angry about? No, I can't even bother. Work it out for yourself. Or better yet, find a trusted friend to talk about who will listen with you in a way that's going to help you, not help you blame somebody else because you're angry. Blaming somebody because you're angry never works. I'm going to stop now, otherwise I'll keep going. This is the second question that came via text. So that's okay, I can receive questions by text too. Don't send me a question to me now and expect it to be answered right now. I don't have my phone with me. How does our current model of church reflect the church in Acts? They centered around the dinner table, shared their journeys, and supported each other as a true family. Pardon me. How does coming to a Sunday service, receiving the message in a lecture format, and then going home even come close to the richness of sharing a meal and literally doing life together and journeying through hardship? Is it not a watered-down approach, an approach encouraging apathy, a faith centered around only receiving and not living with those around you or out of your faith? How is that close to what God calls us into as his church? My emotion now is a bit embarrassed because I've got a sermon to prepare and I feel like it's a bit of a lecture. So that's what I've got to go with. I've spoken to this person, and again, so if you're going to ask a question, you need to give me a name so at least I can follow up. And I've spoken to this person, and I basically said, I'm not answering that question. I haven't got that long. But there's a degree to which they're right. This current format in which we have Sunday worship together barely reflects the early church and their enthusiasm of doing fellowship together. And we have this passage from Acts chapter 2. Awe came upon everyone. Just checking who's feeling awed now. Okay, maybe we're just the quiet types. It's really hard to tell if you're feeling awed with a mask on, because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. That's a powerful story, isn't it? How does this reflect that? That's a good question. I don't have an easy answer for that. And I've thought about what sort of answer I would give. And I feel like it's only tinkering at the margins. Like we can change. And I've been part of a few conversations in recent weeks and months. But basically for the last, and I've reflected about this with some people, for my entire time in ministry, which is now coming up to, 22 years or so, I feel like I've been in a review process. I feel like the church has been consistently reviewed. We're in a period where everything is getting reviewed in the church, in the denominational structures, in our worship. changing things, adapting things, making things new, going back to the old, holding the traditions, making new traditions, telling new stories, telling the old stories but better, finding new ways to engage people. 20 years of review. Through that time, I've seen congregations rise and fall for a whole host of reasons and in a whole host of ways. I've seen congregations that are doing things differently and then hear the heartache about how they actually continue that. How do they stabilize the energy of doing this different thing when it started out like a good idea, but after a while they realized they need to put some structure and some meaning around it that wasn't there to begin with. And then others who are intentional and groups that meet together on a regular basis, but the cost is quite high. That sense of being together really is that close-knit community where they do gather together, where they spend a lot of time together, where they're praying together, where they are learning scripture together, where they break bread together, where they trust one another, where they, with their finances and with their resources, where they make vows to one another at a deep level about how they will live in relationship. And for the last 20 years, this is what it's been, if not longer. After the church growth movement and that sort of peaked and then started going down, and the church keeps trying to reinvent itself. And so my response, aside from I don't know, is what's God calling us to? Ultimately, what's God actually calling us to? And from my part, I'm a bit sick and tired of being told that our way of, and this is not what this question is doing, by the way, and I don't have an issue with this question being asked at all, but I am a bit sick and tired of being told we're going to do something different to be better, because I keep seeing different and it isn't better. What I do see, though, and what I hear about are groups of people who find themselves moulded by God in such a way that they choose to live this new way with vigour. And so the bottom line is, people, do you want to follow God or do you want to follow an idea? Do you want to believe in God and do you want to follow Jesus Christ faithfully, or do you just want to sort of skirt around the edges and play around with ideas until people agree with you? I've been there and I've done that. It's really easy to critique. I've been part of critiquing groups. I've done the critiquing. It only gets you so far. The big question then becomes, will you follow Jesus? And Christian and non-Christian both want to talk about it, but then we find difficult how to actually practice it. And so my answer to this question is going to be, see, now I'm angry. You can tell, yeah. And I know why I'm angry, and there's not much I can do about my anger at the moment. Because I know internally my way of following Jesus isn't all I'd like it to be either. I looked over my history of following Jesus and I think, yeah, would Jesus be pleased if he came through the door today? I don't know. And even hoping, believing and hoping that my desire to please Jesus would please Jesus. Maybe. So an answer might be, follow Jesus and investigate that in your own hearts. Explore that in your own ways. How are you following Jesus in such a way that you're being honest with Jesus? Don't attach all the other stuff. I want to follow Jesus so that we can have something like Acts. What happened in Acts happened. What's going to happen today? I have no idea. But I do know that the constant call is to follow Jesus and be faithful to that. And there is a danger in harking back to Acts and saying, why can't we be more like that? Well, because we're not there. And I have a sneaking suspicion that part of the story is told through rose-coloured glasses. Not completely. But the bottom line is they were gathering together and they were praying together and they were of the belief that Jesus was calling them to something new. Does anybody have any responses to that? Does anybody want to say anything? Have I stepped over a line? I mean, I'm okay if I have, but if I haven't, Maybe I need to push a little harder. As I say, it's a conversation. I'll stop. Unless somebody's got anything they want to say. Okay. Good question. It's actually four or five questions in one. But it's a good question. And it's a great question. How is that close to what God calls us into as his church? I mean, that's, forget about what I think. Honestly, forget about what I think. What does God call us into? And that's the bottom line. What is God calling us into as his church? Now to the lecture part, which will be brief. And it'll be brief because I think there's a lot in these two passages from Mark's Gospel, the Syrophoenician woman and the friends. It's interesting that we call it the Syrophoenician woman who speaks for her daughter, but it's the healing of the blind, the deaf mute who's brought by his friend. We don't tell a story about the friends. It's not the story of the friends that bring the deaf mute. The story we tell, until we have a story to tell, the dogs still need to be fed. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights says this, and I'm not going to read it in its entirety, nor the preamble, but some of the preamble is worth hearing in this context. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind, and the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want has been proclaimed as the highest aspiration of the common people. Whereas it is essential, if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, then human rights should be protected by the rule of law. Whereas it is essential to promote the development of friendly relations between nations. Whereas the peoples of the United Nations have in the Charter reaffirmed their faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women, and have determined to promote social progress and better standards of life and larger freedom. The first human right is that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. All human beings are born equal. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. If only Jesus had these with him at the time, perhaps Jesus may have glimpsed a piece of the kingdom which he was proclaiming. But then we wouldn't see the rich reward of this conversation that emerges between the Syrophoenician woman and the man who is deaf and mute. Because both of these people are in Gentile territory. They are both on the outside. They are not part of the chosen race. They are not God's chosen people. And Jesus has gone up for some interesting reason, which I would like to know more about, but unfortunately there's no detail. Jesus goes north to Tyre to have a rest. He goes to a Gentile territory, so that's okay, to have a rest. But unfortunately, his reputation precedes him, and a Syrophoenician woman finds him, and she comes to him and asks for her daughter to be made well. One of these astonishingly simple things is that the Syrophoenician woman knows that even if she is not an Israelite, she can still be helped. Jesus still has a responsibility to act towards her in a spirit of brotherhood, regardless of her place in his society. And we have that rather difficult term that she's referred to as a dog. No way, there's no nice way. This is not a household pet. This is not that lovely little dog that you've got at home that you like sort of curling up on your feet or sitting in your lap or biting your hands as some do. This is, the intent is that this is an annoying animal. And the woman says, yes, but even dogs eat the crumbs off the master's table. Mick Duncan, in his Pattern of Evangelism, says everyone's on the page. No matter where you think you are, everyone's on the page. It's not about being in or out, this region or that region, who's closer to God or who's further away from God, or the old picture we may have had about where you put yourself in relation with the cross and the chasm in the middle, and the cross has sort of sits on the chasm. And where are you in relation? If God's on one side, where are you? Mick says everyone's on the page. And he says even if they're not even inquiring, even if they're not even interested in God, they are on the far right-hand side, my right, your left, doesn't matter. Everyone's on the page. And then he goes through the conversation points about where people might be. But then he says, you might think, oh, it's moving across the page, but even then you're still, there's always this circling back and going backwards and forwards with different aspects of inquiring on the page. The point is this. How do we open our minds up to see that we can advocate for anybody because anybody is on the page? We don't just have to advocate for the ones that we think God will respond to. Everyone's on the page, and therefore, what would it be like, rather than saying, are they worth it? Should we? Can we? Do we? Do they belong? Are they part of us? Who's in need that you know of? Plain and simple. And go to God with that need. Because everyone's on the page. And we have these two stories, and I want to focus, there's a lot in them to unpack, so I want to focus on just one area, and that's the fact that the Syrophoenician woman comes for her daughter. Her daughter can't do it. Her daughter's unable, being possessed by a demon of whatever sort, and there's a whole other conversation about that. But this Syrophoenician woman comes for her daughter, and her daughter's not even there in the room with Jesus. She doesn't bring her daughter to him. She just goes and says, you've got to help me here. My daughter's sick. You can do something. And she is persistent, desperately defiant in her need for her daughter to be made well. Which is kind of a good thing for us, because we have that slight difficulty that we do not have the physical presence of Jesus in the way that they had the physical presence of Jesus, and therefore we may want to ask, well, how do we get people to Jesus? Well, don't worry about that. Just pray. Just knock on the door and say, I'm here, you've got to help me. I've got somebody here that needs my help, that needs your help. Then we have these friends, still in Gentile territory, a long, long way from Tyre. Jesus went further north, then came back down south and away to the west, away to the east. Still in Gentile territory. And these friends bring, a deaf mute to Jesus. And all of a sudden we see this pattern in these two stories that the person cannot speak for themselves. And they need somebody else to do it for them. And so a question that I want to ask, and I'm asking of myself, and you might want to ask for yourself, is who is it that you need to be speaking for? Who is it that you need to be the advocate for with God? Because they're voiceless. They cannot do it themselves. And this group of friends bring their friend to Jesus. He's deaf and he's mute. You know, he has a speech impediment. Traditionally said he's mute, but a speech impediment. Completely different healing way. Jesus takes him away from the crowds where they can't be seen, gets all tactile, spits on his tongue, ooh, but apparently quite a normal thing to do when you want to heal people in that scenario. By the way, that's not an encouragement to go and do that. If I hear stories that you've been going around spitting in people's mouths, I'm going to be really quite concerned. And Jesus heals the man away from the crowd. The first scenario, not even in the same area. And it's because of the woman's tenaciousness that her daughter's healed. Here we've got a group of friends that beg for Jesus. The woman falls at Jesus' feet. And a reflection I've had for myself is, am I praying with enough tenacity? Are my prayers too pious and too polite? Am I not knocking enough at Jesus' door, demanding entry? It's just a reflection for myself. By the way, I'm not a, you know, that might not be, but I thought I'd just throw it out there. And Jesus heals them completely differently. And always the, don't tell anybody about this, by the way, just keep this to yourself, which of course doesn't work, because the one who was once voiceless now has a voice. And the ones that were now speaking for the deaf mute are now speaking for Jesus. And we have this scenario where people are speaking on behalf of other people. For whom are you speaking out? Who do you need to be speaking? Who do we need to be speaking out for? And there's a whole raft. In a couple of weeks' time, we'll be having a prayer meeting here for the people of Afghanistan. But it's one group of people out of hundreds that need our prayers. Are we doing that enough? I happened to glance through the TV last night. There wasn't much on, except for SBS that was showing the King's Speech. I thought, oh, do I really want to watch? You know how you think, oh, that movie was all right, but in your memory it sort of grows a little. I thought, oh, do I really want to watch this again? And I did, right through. And I was glad I did. Because it, for those of you who may not be aware, King George VI has a speech impediment, stammers, and finds somebody to help him with that. Played by Geoffrey Rush, Lionel Logue. And he has this wonderful line as they're standing in the chapel, preparing themselves for the king's ordination. And Geoffrey Rush, playing Lionel Logue, tells his story about why he started doing this to help people. Because the king has found out that he's actually not a doctor. He has no experience in this line of work at all, apparently. In fact, he's a failed actor with not much income. And Lionel says this one thing, talking about people who came back from the war, and someone said to him, Lionel, you're good at this kind of thing, aren't you? You're good at doing all this talking and speaking. Maybe you can help these people who are coming back with what we now call PTSD and who simply cannot speak, who find themselves silent from the terror of war. And he goes on to say, my job was to give them faith in their own voice and let them know a friend was listening. My job was to give them faith in their own voice and let them know a friend was listening. Are we listening enough? Or do I, you know, it's easier not to listen because there's just too many voices out there crying out to be heard. For whom are you speaking? Perhaps we need to widen the circle of God's grace, not only speaking out for the powerful and for the privileged, because for those who can speak for themselves, but beyond the borders of our natural habitation, a world is present and is waiting for somebody to speak on its behalf. For those who feel like they have no voice, for those who feel like nobody will speak for them or nobody can speak for them, because we don't talk about that kind of thing. We don't talk about anger. We don't talk about having this. We don't talk about having that. We don't talk about these sorts of things. Or we keep people away from things because that's their scenario. That's got nothing to do with us. We don't want to deal with it. Of course, the question will come, but Anthony, where would we start? And when we start, where do we stop? I don't know. I don't know. I'm not here to tell you that. I know, and I'm fairly sure, I reckon, that the Syrophoenician woman went home to her daughter and picked her up and hugged her. She then didn't go out looking for more children to go speaking for. She did the one thing that she needed to do, and that was speak for her daughter. The one thing that she needed to do. The friends didn't go and set up a new campaign for those. Maybe they wanted to, and maybe they did, but we don't know. And that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that they came to Jesus. And they said, we need you to do this for us. And I know that because I've asked this question myself, yeah, but it doesn't always work like that. I've prayed for people. I've prayed for people who have been sick and near death, and it doesn't work. People have died, people have stayed sick. I gave my heart to it and wondered, well, what's the deal? And I have no answers for that, other than an invitation to trust that, well, God, who is God, and I'm not. So I'm going to, that's a big thing to remember. But God is God, and God in his wisdom has not answered the prayer that I wanted, in the way that I wanted, in the way that I'd hoped. Does that mean, therefore, that I need to stay silent? Should I not pray next time? Should I not knock on that door and say, I need to be heard because I've got somebody here for you? Jesus Christ, I've got somebody. I know you're resting, by the way. Sorry to break in on your rest, Jesus. There's nothing worse than going away for a holiday and you get that phone call and you think, I better answer this, and then regret that you have. But that's what happens here. And Jesus answers the request. So I know that the end is not always just. And the mercy of God, by the way, seems very fickle and unfair sometimes. But cry out anyway. And I know that we have no way of knowing how Jesus will answer your cry. Simply, there are no guarantees. And please, the one thing that you will get me angry about is if I hear a blanket, if you just do this, everything will be fine. I will be on your tail in a heartbeat and telling you, don't say that, because it's just not true. Because that will tell a story about how you've experienced something that simply cannot be translated into somebody else's experience. But if you say, look, I don't know how Jesus will answer your cry, but I do believe that Jesus listens, and sometimes that might be enough. And sometimes in saying something to Jesus, you might come to a new understanding. And sometimes in speaking to Jesus, you might actually find your prayer answered in a way that you'd hoped. Please don't preempt what Jesus will do. And if you hear me doing that, call me on it. Just not out in public when I'm in front of everybody. But we need to be called on those sorts of things. There's no blanket. And as we saw, two totally different healing scenarios, two totally different realities. And there's no telling if the words you say and the prayers you utter with all your might will find rebuttal or a rebuke or an answer. But pray anyway, because Jesus, I do believe that Jesus listens. I do believe that Jesus hears us and Jesus knows our deepest need. And it's worth doing that for any sake. So we're going to finish with a simple song that we know well. There's one aspect of this song that we don't have that I would like to have included in that sense of going to Jesus with these prayers, and there probably are quite a number of songs that would do that as well. But I love the image here, I will be the Christ light for you in the night time of your fear.